We are continuing to kind of look at that and talk about that and how God had moved in the nation of Israel. And when they come into the land, God had given them the days of the judges. We're basically looking at Israel's disobedience. Unfortunately, they do not keep the covenant with God that God intended to have with them and that God did keep with them. And so tonight we are going to look at the days of the kings. He gave them the judges, of course, the book of Judges. And we're going to look at the days of the kings. So 1 Samuel chapter number 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Turn there and we'll see the beginning here. 1 Samuel 8. Now, in the near future, I am going to bring the whiteboard up and kind of do kind of an overview of where we are. When we get to the cross, we'll do an overview of kind of where we are, how we've gotten here, just to review how God has been dealing with man. And it seems to be that when God deals with man and deals with man differently or changes or adds something to how he's dealing with man, he makes a covenant with somebody. And so we're going to see here, maybe tonight, maybe not tonight, probably not tonight. We're going to get into here as we're in the age of the law, we're going to understand that God makes a covenant with Moses to begin this age of the law, but then he makes a second covenant, a special covenant with David. And so two covenants are happening here under the same time period. Nothing's changing except God came down and said, I'm going to make a covenant with David, a special covenant, a specific everlasting covenant with David, moving forward from there. I'll give you time if you want to just rip that open right now. Just do it. Thank you. Candy wrappers in church. Those are good. Anyone that's opening a candy in church, you're allowed to just go like this and stare at them, all right, from wherever. Wherever you are, if you can hear it, just be like this. I'm kidding. That's not a good friend. What a good friend does later is, why are you opening candy in church? Stop it. Open your candy before church. That's what a good, so if someone doesn't do that, you don't have good friends, all right? That's what it is. I know I'm calling you out specifically here. You don't know who it is exactly in the front row. It was the one with the candy. All right. 1 Samuel chapter number 8, we're going to look at here the days of the kings. 1 Samuel chapter number 8, look here in verse number 4. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse number 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel, unto Ramah, and said unto him, behold, thou art old. Well, that was nice of him. And thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. So up until Samuel here, Samuel is the priest. He takes over after Eli, and God blesses him. And Samuel becomes a judge of Israel as well. Now all these judges that judged Israel judged him differently. And so Samuel might not have been out there swinging the sword, but Samuel was judging Israel and keeping them in line while he was judging them. And they come to him here in verse 5 and say, you're old and your sons don't walk in your ways, in thy ways. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Verse 6, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. Can you turn me down just a little bit, please? And so here we see Israel coming to Samuel and saying, give us a king. And Samuel's upset over it. Samuel's upset because Samuel understands that God has a way of operating and God wants to operate in a certain way. And the people are saying, just, we've had these judges and they're coming and they're going, just give us kings like everybody else has kings, because we want to be like the nations and just have someone that can be on the throne. We know how it works, and they can just reign over us all the time. And Samuel's displeased because he knows that that's not what God desires. And look in verse number 19, same chapter, verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refuse to obey. Samuel goes down here and says, well, you can have a king, but let me tell you what a king's going to do. A king is going to do king things. That means if he's a king, he's going to expect some stuff. And he's going to take of your best, and he's going to set up, and he's going to tax you, and he's going to take the best of your children and make them servants for him. And you want a king, that you're going to get some things with a king. In verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man unto his city. And so God gives them a warning. He tells Samuel, go out and speak to them and say, listen, if you want this, this is going to come with some things you won't want. They say, we just want to be like the nations, that our king may judge us, verse 20, and go out before us and fight our battles. It's had nothing to do with right or wrong. And this is what Israel, over and over again, doesn't get. It's something that you and I, in our own lives, in our own walk with God, need to understand, is that Israel neglected to see that the problem was sin, disobedience to God. Because God said, this is the law. Listen, if you keep this, if you keep my law, if you keep my statutes and my commandments, if you keep these, I will bless you. And if you don't keep these, I will curse you. I will cut you off from amongst your people. He speaks in the law. He speaks corporate law, saying, I will bless you as a nation if you keep my law and keep my commandments. And then he says, if someone breaks this law, I will cut them off from their people. If a soul sin, I will cut them off. That's not everybody. That is, if a soul sins, I will cut off that individual from the people, from life. Often to cut off means he's going to kill them. They will be killed. If you don't keep this, then I will do this. Corporately, as God made a covenant with his people as the nation of Israel, he had already made a covenant with Abraham to say, you're my chosen people. God makes this covenant of a kingdom with them and says, you're going to be a kingdom of priests unto me. You're going to be a peculiar people. That means not weird, drawn to himself. You're going to be my people. And Israel neglected to understand that their problem was their disobedience to God. It wasn't in their form of leadership. That wasn't the problem. It wasn't, well, that guy Moses, remember? Because that's what they started with. Oh, that guy Moses. And then Moses is off the scene, and Joshua leads them in, and they're fighting battles, and they're winning battles, and they're taking land, and everything's going pretty good. And Joshua says, all right, we have our land, and you got to go in and take people out. And the next generation comes in, and they say, we don't remember Joshua. We don't care about the elders. And they start doing things. Oh, Lord, help us. And then the judge comes in and bails them out. And then they go into apostasy. And the judge comes in and bails them out. And then they go back to serving idols. And over again, they say, well, we don't like these judges. Isn't that what they're saying now? We don't like these judges. We want a king. Everyone else has kings. Look at them all. Look at all these nations around us. They all have kings. We want a king. And it couldn't have anything to do with us. It must have to do with our form of government, our leadership. Right? Not understanding that It's the problem is their disobedience and their sin. And as Christians, we need to understand that most of our problem is a sin problem. It's not the Bible. That's not the problem. The preacher has his own problems, but it's usually not the preacher. That's usually not the problems. There's this other church, and with this other church, and that church there, we just don't like how they do everything. It's probably not the church's problems. It's probably a sin problem. A disobedience to God problem is generally what it is. And we need to understand that as well as God deals with us. But here's Israel, and they say, well, we want a king. Give us a king. And, of course, this king was not rejecting Samuel. It was rejecting the Lord. The Lord said, I'm going to be everything for you. And I'm going to operate through men that I choose and raise them up. And sometimes in Judges, it was a woman. I'm going to raise them up, and I'm going to use them to deliver you. But I'm the one that you're answering to. And they said, no, we don't want to answer to you. We want to answer to a king. And so now the Lord knew this temptation was going to be there. Look in Deuteronomy chapter number 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. And look down in verse 14. Deuteronomy 17, 14. When thou art come up into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. The Lord says, you don't have to do this, but this is probably what you're going to do. This is probably what you're going to say. Verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. And it shall be, when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests of the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Five different things. He's to copy out the book of the law. He's to copy this out, make a copy for himself, and read some of it every single day. Why? For those five things, so that he won't be lifted up, so that he prolong his days, he won't turn from it, he'll be able to lead and govern. Now, it wasn't wrong necessarily to ask for a king, it was the purpose of asking for the king. We want to be like everybody else. Not we want a king to know what you want from us, Lord. No, it was we want a king because everybody else has a king. And everyone else seems to be going fine, and we have these issues, I think a king's going to fix it. And so God lays out some rules for a king. He lays them out because he knew they were going to look around and want one. And he said, if you're going to take a king, these need to be some things that happen. And so understanding here that God does give them a king, Israel was just as responsible to the law of God under a king as they were from Moses to Samuel. Just because Israel got themselves a king didn't mean that personal responsibility was now just void. Because God was going to give them a king, and God was going to set them up with a good king, and he was going to try to bless them even with a king, and God was going to try to use that king to rule and to reign over them, There is still a personal responsibility to the law of God under the king, the same way it was from Moses all the way until where we're reading now, where we pick up in Samuel, where he goes and gives them a king. And so God does give them kings, and he gives them the rulers. He gives them the days of the king. Now, Saul takes the throne around 1095 B.C. All right, 1095 B.C. is roughly when Saul takes the throne. And in the final years of Judah, in their kings, the final year there is around, it's around 585 B.C. Say, how long is that? 510 years. 510 years are the days of the kings. And God gives them kings. God sets them up at the beginning, and God blesses them. God chooses the men that he wants on the throne, and he starts with Saul. And Saul starts out well, and Saul ends up disobeying the Lord. And the Lord says, all right, I'm going to take the kingdom from you. And then he says, I'm going to give them to somebody else, someone that's more after my own heart, and he gives the kingdom to David. And of course, you understand David, and then Solomon is on the king. And so the years of Saul and David and Solomon are 120 years. 120 years. They each reign 40 years. That takes them from 1095 to 975 B.C. 120 years of these kings that God lays out for them. And under Saul, although was Saul perfect? No, he was not. He was not. But God was blessing the nation of Israel. All right, and they were, as a whole, they were adhering to the Lord. They were still keeping the things that God wanted as a nation, even though Saul was messing it up. Right, and then God gave him David. David was a man after God's own heart. David was the Lord's anointed. And David was a good man. Was he perfect? No, he was not. And even David, for being the man that you and I should hope to be for the Lord, at least with our heart, David started to multiply to himself wives. And we see that a king's not supposed to do that. We just read it. And came some wealth came with that. We see more wealth under Solomon, but some wealth had come with conquering. But David had started to multiply to himself wives, and he started to get himself in trouble a little bit. And David had his own problems with Bathsheba and Uriah and numbering the people. And but God was blessing the nation of Israel. Under David, he reestablished and made concrete the Levitical priesthood again that was lost during the time of the judges. And this isn't all stuff we're going to go over in great detail, but God's using David to bring the Levitical priesthood back, and he sets them in order by their courses, and he gives them structure. Why? Because they were the ones that were going to be taking the sacrifices and bringing that to God, and God was blessing the nation of Israel. And the same under Solomon. Was Solomon perfect? Absolutely not. He really multiplied to himself wives. And as the Bible says, he brought him wives, and he brings them all these horses. Listen, if you're not supposed to get horses out of Egypt, you probably shouldn't get a wife out of Egypt. That's what he did. Solomon brought his wife out of Egypt, and yet understood that she wasn't allowed to be around the house of God, and he builds her own house. And from there, he multiplies wives, and he gets himself in trouble, and his heart turns after other gods. And he repents and gets those things taken care of, and he gets some things settled. And God is still blessing the nation of Israel, but the nation of Israel now is starting to stray. They're starting to stray. And they've been good, and they're good at following the leader for a little bit. And then all of a sudden, those are the only three kings where the kingdom is fully united. And then after that, you know what happens in reading the Bible is Rehoboam comes on the throne. Rehoboam comes on the throne, makes some bad decisions, and the kingdom splits into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom is what happens. And that northern kingdom is from 975, that's the end of Solomon's reign, 975 to around 721 B.C. And around 721 B.C., Assyria comes in, and the northern kingdom has been a mess ever since Solomon. The northern kingdom has 19 kings that reign over them. And it ends up being, I forget how many family dynasties that get torn down and another family brought up, and God uses somebody else to bring them down. And all 19 of those kings do not serve the Lord of those northern tribes. They turn from God. Jeroboam comes in. You know the story. Jeroboam comes in for Israel and sets up everything to worship idols. He's trying to preserve his own kingship, keeping them away from Jerusalem and the southern tribe and Rehoboam. And he sets up everything, and they start worshiping idols, and they never go back. There's individuals that serve God. But as the northern tribes, those kings come in, they set the pace, and Israel's in trouble. Israel's in trouble. And that southern kingdom comes in and takes over in 975 Rehoboam, and they don't go into captivity until 585, roughly 585 B.C. Is when they finally go, the last piece of captivity happens. And they go into captivity to Babylon. And what happens there? They have 19 kings as well. 19 kings as well. And they are all of one line. Of one line. That line is from the line of David. And some of those kings do well, and some of those kings don't do well. Some of them, the nation as a, the southern tribe as a whole, and even some of the northern individuals of the northern tribes, they have revival under some of the kings that lift up the Lord, and there's other kings that bring Judah down into apostasy. And so while all this is going on with the leaders, God is holding the individuals responsible for what they're going to do with what God has said. Not much unlike you and I today. There's going to be another vote in November for president. And there's going to be a president that's going to be placed into the White House. And no matter who's there, no matter what laws they're passing, no matter what's going on in the White House or the governor of Washington, whatever he's doing, right, we're responsible to the Lord for right. We're responsible for what God has said in his word. You and I wish it was easier. I wish we had righteous leaders. I wish we had leaders that were for right and for serving God and for morality, but we don't. And we can just read the Bible, and we know which direction America is going to go with all the rest of them. It's going to go the way of the Antichrist. We're fast-tracking our way straight to hell and say, what's going to help us? Well, God saved our souls, thank God, if you're saved and born again. And we're just going to serve him and go forward as long as we can serve him and go forward. And what's going to happen in the future? I don't know what's going to happen. Well, what's it going to be like for our kids to serve God? I don't know what it's going to be like for our kids to serve God. But what are we going to do? Serve God. Serve God. Well, what if they come in and shut us down and we can't have church anymore? They shut us down for church. We'll figure it out. I'll come to your house and we'll have Bible study. It'll take me a while to get around everywhere, but we'll do it. Say why? Because we're going to do what God wants us to do. And we're going to, listen, in America, we're so spoiled. We're so spoiled. We don't even, I got to be careful here. We get so spoiled about things, and since, you know, in the last 8 years or so, politics has become a god to a lot of Christians. and it has replaced the Bible. And now being read is more important than being a Christian. And yeah, that's just what it is. That's just where we are now. We don't even understand that, you know, when we have Brother Virginio here for a missions conference, he didn't say a lot about it. Maybe I should have asked him to say more about it. But they're not allowed to have church. Like, the government doesn't allow them to have church. They're not allowed to do what we do. They can't just buy a piece of property and put up a sign and say, we're going to worship here. They're not allowed to do that. So what do? They meet. And they worship together. And they witness with discretion. And they do all the, they rent apartments, and then they pad the walls of the apartments so that when they sing, maybe the neighbors won't call the cops and turn them in. They try to befriend their cops. They try to befriend the neighbors to say, this is what we are. We're not really trying to cause a problem. That's what they do. We don't understand that in America. We don't understand what that type of persecution would mean. If the government would come in and say, listen, you can't meet as a church. You can't have this property and meet. You know what some people would do? Never meet again. Because they don't understand what it might mean to have a church, even when the government might say, you can't have a church. I'm not hoping for this. Lord, give us freedom as long as you can. Lord, bless us. Bless your people. Give us freedom to do this. But we're not guaranteed that freedom. I mean, did you know that the American Constitution is not our God-given right? I am really thankful for the Constitution that we have. And the government that was started in America, and I think America is the best country. But our right to own a gun is not a God-given right. It's a constitutional. I told you it was going to get a little dicey if I kept going. If I kept going, it was going to get dicey. I'm glad we can own guns. It's not a God-given right. I have a missionary friend. You've heard me say, I should just tell you his name and then just get it out there and I can just refer to him by name. He's a missionary in Montreal, Canada. And he talks with some of us here in the United States and people start talking about guns and they have this and they have that. And he says, I wish I could own a gun. But guess what? He lives in Canada. He can't own a gun. And say, what does he do? I don't know. He probably can't serve God if he can't own a gun. He probably can't do it. I mean, he can't own a gun. He lives in a socialist country, and he has to do this and do that and the whole thing and say, what is he doing? Trying to serve God. He's trying to win souls and have a church and teach them how to be Christians. Well, he should fight the government to be able to have a gun. Yeah, hold on. Yeah, I'm out. I don't know. I can't find it. I'm glad that we have the freedoms we have, but as a Christian, we're supposed to serve the Lord no matter what happens. We have an individual responsibility to serve the Lord, and whatever comes down the road. And it's easy to say it now. It's easy to stand up here and act like I have just this, you know, backbone of steel, because I'm standing up here and we have the freedom to do it, and I have the freedom to say these things. But we'll see what happens as time goes on if the Lord doesn't continue to give us these liberties. We'll see, all of us, our backbone will be tested for Christ and what we're willing to do for him. And so we have an individual responsibility, as did the Israelites under these kings. And God was faithful to his promises, but Israel did not keep their end of the kingdom covenant. Remember that? Exodus chapter 19 is the nation of Israel. Whatever God says, we'll do it. That's what they said, right? Moses says, all right, I'm going to take it. And Moses goes to the people and he says, God wants to bring you up. He's bringing you out of Egypt and he's going to give you this law and he's going to give you his commandment and he's going to make you a special people. He's going to make you a people special to himself and he's going to make you his kingdom of priests and he's going to do all these things. And they take it to the people and the people say, whatever God says, that's what we'll do. Moses says, you sure? Whatever God says, we're going to do it. I mean, Moses had already heard the grumblings. Moses had already been with the people. Because I'm going to take your answer back to the Lord. Take it back to God. We're going to do it. Remember Joshua? It says, "What it, me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And you can't serve the Lord. You got these idols. And we're going to serve God. We're going to do it." Well, you can't serve him with all your idols. We're going to serve him. We love our house too. We're going to serve God. And they're sealing their own fate because God made the covenant with them. Turn to the book of Ezekiel, chapter number 8. Ezekiel, chapter number 8. Now, the book of Ezekiel has some different dates around the time it was written and different times. But I'm going to give it somewhere around 590 B.C., I would say it's probably within 5 to 10 years of Judah going fully into captivity. All right, so I know I'm not writing these numbers down for you, but we're 5 to 10 years within Judah going into captivity, and Ezekiel is prophesying, and he's prophesying these visions. Ezekiel chapter number 8, look in verse number 1, Ezekiel chapter 8, verse number 1. And it came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I sat in mine house, and the elders of Judah sat before me, that the hand of the Lord fell there upon me. Then I beheld, and lo, a likeness as the appearance of fire, from the appearance of his loins even downward, fire, and from his loins even upward, as the appearance of the brightness as the color of amber. And he put forth the form of an hand and took me by a lock of mine head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. Now Ezekiel is in captivity already. All right, so roughly 606 BC, there's an invasion of Babylon, and Babylon comes in and starts to take over Israel. And they do that, but they don't take over everything. They leave some leadership in charge of Jerusalem. They take some people away. They take some of Israel. They take them into captivity, but some of them are still there in their land, and they're saying, we'll just set up, and we're going to set up our own your own kings, but we'll set them up for you, and they'll be in control until, like I said, later they go in and finally kind of take over everything and kind of tear up what Israel knows as their own leadership and their own monarchs and those types of things. So here in captivity here is Ezekiel has this vision. God comes down and picks him up in this vision and plops him down in Jerusalem. We see that here in verse number 3. To the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoketh to jealousy? And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the vision that I saw in the plain. All right, so the glory of God is there. You see it in verse number 4. This is, I'm making a point here about this. The glory of the Lord is there, and it's in Jerusalem. It's in this place. Look in verse number 7. This is what he sees. And he brought me to the door of the court. Now, this is the court of the house of the Lord. And when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I had digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said unto me, go in, and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And he sees these 70 men, these ancient men. Verse 12, and he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, the Lord seeth us not, the Lord hath forsaken the earth? And he said also unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. And he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which is toward the north. And behold, there sat a woman weeping for Tamuz. And he goes down through here, and he sees there in the inner court, verse 16, the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. And he points them out here. He's looking at all their abominations in verse 17 that they commit. And so if you remember or not, the main doors into the outer court of the temple were coming in. We'll do it in your direction here. We're coming in from the east, and they were to come in. So if you were going to come in, there was the temple. You'd come in from the doors on the east, and you'd be facing the tabernacle here. It was long in this direction, be facing the temple. It was in this direction here, and you'd come, and you'd come to the brazen altar, and then after that, there's the laver, and then you'd go into the actual temple, all right? So they were going east to west in this direction here. So you come in, of course, this is north, that's south, and that's west, right? They're coming in from the east. And so he goes there to the temple, and he looks, and he sees the leaders there, and their backs are to the temple where God is. Because remember, God sits in the most holy place there on the Ark of the Covenant. And they're facing away from where God sits, and they're facing where the sun comes up in the east, and they're worshiping the sun. In the temple there, they're worshiping the sun. And God says, you see it? You see it, Ezekiel? See what they're doing? See what they're doing in Jerusalem? Now, Ezekiel's here with some elders, and they're trying to serve the Lord. I mean, Ezekiel is serving God. God's speaking to him. He's the prophet. He's telling them what God's going to do. And he says, you want to see what's going on back? The place where I've put my name, isn't that what God said? You're going to worship in the place where I've put my name. And they go back, and he gives them this vision. He goes back, and he sees it. Look in chapter number 10. Now, chapter number 10 is... again, he's seeing these cherubims. He mentions them in chapter 1 of Ezekiel and in chapter 10. But we're not getting into the cherubims, all right? So look here in verse number 4, Ezekiel 10, verse 4. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house. And the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of the Lord's glory. The Lord is still there in the house of the Lord. The glory of the Lord is there on the threshold of the house of the Lord. And the cloud fills the temple just like it did in the Old Testament. And Solomon had prayed, and things had happened there when they built the temple, and God had moved. And God was so thick on the Old Testament tabernacle that Moses would come out and his face would shine. And the people would say, well, we can't look at him. We're afraid. And they wouldn't even go into the Old Testament temple because the Lord was there. And he said, this is where I'm going to dwell above in the cherubim there. And now he sees these cherubim. And now from the most holy place where God said he would be, he's now at the threshold of the door. He's moved now to the threshold of the door. And he's here. And he's still, because his presence is there, if you can envision it, God is there. He's at the threshold even. And there are the 25 elders that are facing away from God, and they're worshiping the sun. I mean, that's where their idolatry and abominations are. And God is right there on the threshold. All right, we'll look down in verse number 17. When they stood, he's still talking about the cherubims, and he's talking about this wheel inside the wheel and this whole thing. Verse 17, when they stood, these stood, and when they were lifted up, these lifted up themselves also. Look what it says. For the spirit of the living creature was in them. When the glory of the Lord departed from off the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubims. All right, so we know where God's supposed to be. We can see that in the Old Testament clearly. He's supposed to be in the most holy place, behind the veil, and he's there above the Ark of the Testimony, on the mercy seat. That's where God was going to be. God was going to meet with them. Then he gives this vision to Ezekiel, and he sees God, now the cloud is now moved to the threshold of the door. But now these cherubim are here, and they come down to the temple, and God's presence is now with, it's now resting above the chair. It's off of the threshold of the door, and it's now resting there. And look in verse 19. And the cherubims lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. And when they went out, the wheels also were beside them, and everyone stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of God, the glory of the God of Israel was over above them. So what's the picture? The picture is here, Ezekiel is looking at, he's seen this vision of Jerusalem. He's seen the vision of the abomination and the wickedness. And God is showing Ezekiel, hey, I'm done here. I'm all done here. And as a nation, say, what happened to Ezekiel? Ezekiel served God. But as a nation, what was happening? God said, this kingdom promise that I've given you, we're putting that on hold. We're putting that on hold. You haven't kept up your end, and you see the abominations, and you see the picture. He moves to the threshold, then from the threshold to above the cherubim, and then the cherubim are at that east gate of the house of the Lord. All right, that's the place where you come in and you go. And then they lift up off the ground, and they start to ascend themselves, and the glory of the Lord is with them. And say, what happens? Well, basically, God takes that back to heaven. The cherubim take the glory of God back to heaven and is no longer resting there. The glory of the Lord departs. And say, what happens? Well, what happens then is, again, we're running several things together. What happens again is Daniel starts to come into play. You know what Daniel says? Daniel says, O King Nebuchadnezzar, you have this image. Let me explain this image to you. You are the head of gold because you are the most powerful, and there will not be a kingdom like you after it. But after you, there's going to come another kingdom, and it's represented by the arms and the chest, and it's two kingdoms instead of one, and it's the kingdoms of the Medes and the Persians. And what's after that? Well, then you have the loins and the part down here to the knees, and that represents Greece. And then after that, you have the legs and the 10 toes, and you see the clay mixed with iron, and Rome starts to take over, and then the 10 toes, because there's 10 different kingdoms. And say, what happens? The time of the Gentiles starts. That's what happens. The time of the Gentiles starts when God moves away from Israel and departs from Israel. God is still dealing with individuals under the law, but the time of the Gentiles has begun. And he will continue to scatter Israel. And Ezekiel's there with the elders, and they're torn up about it. And even in Ezekiel chapter number 11, and you read through Ezekiel, and I understand, I don't have it all down either, all right? But what happens, you start reading through Ezekiel, and what's Ezekiel start doing? He's saying, God's done, but he's not done forever. He's not done forever. And you read chapter after chapter after chapter of Ezekiel, and even in Ezekiel chapter number 11, he starts to get on him, and he talks about God leaving and because of the abominations, and he's going to scatter them all in the winds, and they're going to be going. He says, but there's going to be a remnant. There's going to be a remnant, and I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to bring them back. And you start reading through Ezekiel as he's prophesying to the nation of Israel. You start reading through Ezekiel, and he's telling them this is going to happen, and God's going to do this. He's going to bring us back. He's going to bring us back. And you get in Ezekiel 37 and you start to see the prophecy of God bringing life back to Israel, and you start to see Ezekiel start to, we're going to build another temple. And don't worry, God's going to bring us back and we're going to build and that's a temple that's going to be in eternity, and God's going to do these different things. And he's still telling the nation of Israel that you're still God's people, but because of your disobedience, he's lifted his hand off. He's lifted his hand off of them. And this is what God does in the time of the kings. And this is going to lead us into the days of the prophets, because he's given these prophets to Israel for this purpose, to warn them and to tell them and to have them understand what God, and to warn them about what God has said over and over and over again. Yeah, they have a king, but some of those kings are bums, and they're leading them astray, and the prophets are coming along, and they're prophesying to the kings, and they're prophesying to those around them, saying, you better serve God. You better serve God. Just because they're not serving God, you should serve God. Just because your daddy didn't serve God, you better serve God. That's what he tells many, prophets tell many kings that. And some of them do, and some of them don't. And so the time of the prophets is as God is dealing with his people continually. But by the time the kings are done and they're in captivity, the time of the Gentiles begins. And there's individual times where individuals have opportunities, like Ezra and Nehemiah. They come later. I know that it's not all, Ezra's after Nehemiah, Ezekiel's after, it's because it's not written in chronological order, the Bible. It'd be simpler if it was in some ways for us to understand. But, I mean, you have Ezra and Nehemiah somewhere around 500 BC, somewhere around later than that, 400s BC. So they're coming way after this is happening, 100 years or so after this is happening. What do? They go back and they rebuild the temple, right? But when you read that about Ezra, the people that are there that want the temple there, they're rejoicing. They're shouting and they're crying, and you can't tell the difference between the rejoicing and the crying because of what the temple was. But you never see God come back in the same way with that temple as he was here. When he takes his hand off. Those that want to serve God, he gives them access to continue to serve God. So what about Daniel? Well, Daniel served Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They served God. We see that in the scriptures. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt have no graven images. So what does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do? They stand. We're not bowing down to the image. Why? Because we serve the one true God. And he said we can't bow down. We're supposed to have a special diet. And this diet of the Babylonian king, he's trying to give us all kinds of food. And Daniel and the others that are there, they say, we're not going to defile ourselves with a portion of the king's meat. Why are they doing that? Because they're trying to obey God. They're trying to obey the law because it matters. And it matters to them. And they do serve God in difficult times. Even though the nation has fallen apart, even though Christianity in our nation is falling apart, we don't have to be a part of that. We can say, God help us, and continue to serve God and not just go the way, because we're going to stand before God and be responsible for us. And so God's going to help with that. So next Sunday night, I'm going to talk about that covenant with David, and then talk about the prophets, and then that'll take us through the age of the law. But as you can see, the more pieces you're able to put together, the more things you start to see and understand the timeline of what's happening, the more you're in the book, the more we're going over things like this, you can start to put all these pieces together that kind of gets spread out and unraveled a little bit as you go through. But it's good to do that, and eventually I'll draw some things out for you just to try to pull some of those pieces together for you even still. All right, let's go ahead and be dismissed tonight. Lord, thank you for your goodness and your mercy. Lord, thank you for your book. Lord, there's so much in this book. Lord, it's an amazing thing. Thank you for giving it to us. Thank you that it's pure. Lord, I pray that you'd help us to be what we need to be this week. Be servants and soldiers for you and go out and please you with our lives. Lots of things happening this week in our church. Lord, bless our church. Bless the people in it. Lord, and just I pray that your hand would be upon everything that we do. Thank you again for all that you do for us. Bless us tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.